I am 40, the 29th of April, 1993, to the 28th of April, 1994. Over. Are You My Colin Canth? By Neil Scott. Is this the year when things turn? And am I halfway there yet? I don't see any dancing horses or bolts of lightning. Up in the attic, amidst all my father's ephemera, is a postcard pinned to the ceiling rather than the wall. It's from the British Museum, or maybe the Natural Science Museum. Whichever, it's from one of those grand museums in London that were built and filled to inspire awe and wonder. And I remember feeling both of those emotions, and also feeling very, very small when I recall that visit when I was a wee lad, not yet 10, but already knowing that the world was far bigger, far scarier and far more mysterious to the one that I encountered in my day-to-day living. And I remember standing on tiptoe to peer into the glass tank supported on high metal legs to see what was contained inside. And inside was something that was indeed big, scary and mysterious. It contained something that shouldn't have been there, something that shouldn't be in any tank anywhere except for rare examples that were retrieved from rocks where they had been unearthed as fossils dating back some 65 million years. For in this tank was a living fossil, a living legend, except for this one was not living. It looked very not alive to my younger self. It was the Colin Canth, a leviathan of a fish that was thought to have been extinct for many millions of years. But here it was, not very alive, but definitely not a fossil. This one had been hauled out of the seas off the coast of eastern Africa in 1938 and was now in a slowly decaying but definitely not fossilised state, contained in a glass tank, suspended in a murky solution and in front of my young eyes. I was transfixed. I'd never seen such a thing. Certainly not in the Pencombe Burn, or even hauled on board the fishing boat on which I once sailed to Iceland. And that's an entirely different story. Even with my then active and curious imagination, I don't think I could have conjured up such a weird beastie. It was only more recently that I've learnt more about the Colin Canth, and the reality of it is even weirder than any of my weird conjurings. For, and I have to consult one of my golden notebooks for the details, it really is a creature from beyond time and space, extinct since the late Cretaceous period until one night over 50 years ago. Old Four Legs, as it was nicknamed, reappeared on the deck of the Nereen. The ship's captain described it as a deep blue beauty. They can grow over 6 feet in length, can see in the dark, have vestigial lungs, give birth to live pups, and can swim vertically, upside down and backwards. Yep, a certified weird fucker of a fish. But then, as did much of my early years, it slipped from my mind and retreated into some sunken underwater cavern to quietly skulk around waiting to be rediscovered at some future date. I guess that over 30 years on, I'm rediscovering it, or at least an image of it. For the faded postcard that is pinned to the ceiling in the attic is from the museum gift shop, and has a black and white photo of its preserved remains of this particular Colin Canth, the very one that I peeped at in awe. On the front was a neat white border around the image. But what's the point of all this? Why am I writing about a postcard on an attic ceiling that contains an image of an extinct but not extinct fish, albeit a very weird fish that was caught 55 years ago off the east coast of Africa and that I saw, or believe I saw, at least 30 years ago? Well, it's not my attic. And I suppose you could say that it's not my postcard. But it is now. My neck is cricked from spending too much time looking at the postcard as I reach up and release it from the ceiling. The postcard now has a neat rusty circle in the middle, at the top, from the drawing pin that held it there for decades. I hold the card, then tuck it into the left-hand pocket of my jacket to take home and ponder further. It's my father's attic. It was my father who took me to the museum in London. It was my father who stood with me, peering into the tank as we shared the discovery of the living fossil. It would have been my father who bought the postcard from the museum's gift shop. It was my father who was so evidently enthralled by the coelacanth. His enthrallment lasted longer than mine, as he used to climb the retractable ladder that gives access to his attic on a regular basis, several times a week. And each time he climbed that ladder and passed through the trapdoor leading into the attic, he would have looked up and seen the coelacanth pinned above his head. I like to think that he deliberately pinned it there so he'd see it every time he climbed the well-oiled but still creaking ladder. Like the coelacanth, my father is now dead. He would have been 40 when he took me to the museum in London, and this year I will be 40. For my father, 40 was less than half of his full life. I remember his birthday. We, that is, my mother, my sister, and my wee brother, baked him a cake, and we decorated it. And whilst we had a silver cake decoration for the number 4, we didn't have a knot. So we used the end of my brother's toy trumpet, the end that you blow in, as the knot. It worked well enough. Will I get a home-baked cake to mark my 40th year? I hope so. Will I take another look at that old postcard and perhaps organise a trip to the British Museum? Or was it the Natural History Museum?
Under, Loitering with Discontent by Martin Sketchley. In 1993, I was cruising towards middle-aged gentlemanliness with notoriety. I remained a bottomless pit of half-baked ideas, unpredictable, scary, a disruptor. By this time, I could conjure up a sensationalist headline from my bed. Good job, too, because I had nothing to get out of bed for. A shot of publicity would revive the magic, but the magic fades. And I'd always be left with an empty, so what now feeling. Like when there's no wine in the house and no beer in the fridge. It was a midlife melancholy that was only set to intensify. I'd spent most of my adult life careering from one controversy to the next, perpetually suspended somewhere between excitement and regret, loitering with discontent on breakdown city limits. The opportunity for change came on February 19th, 1994. On Friday the 18th, I was watching Coronation Street when a guitar feedback-like squawk erupted from the TV. I froze, whiskey glass poised before my lips as I absorbed the sonic layers. Put a beat under that, I thought, and some idiot would dance to it. When the noise stopped, I was dumped back into the shenanigans of the street. But I also knew where I had to go and when. I just didn't know why. It was a bit of a journey, and the car was still playing up, but there it was, a summons. I glanced at the uniform grey sky as I drove through the Trossachs National Park. It looked heavy with snow. Maybe I should have packed a blanket and shovel, as advised by wise police officers in such circumstances for countless years. A sandwich and flask, at the very least. But being discovered as a frozen corpse in an MG Metro 1.3 would surely represent the pinnacle of my artistic existence, the thing for which I would always be remembered. I had no idea what to expect, but the further I went, the more the feeling in the pit of my stomach grew. Like when you go over a humpback bridge too fast, or you've swallowed too much swimming pool water. I hate that. I was wondering whether to stop and throw up when I rounded the next bend and hit the brakes. The metro skidded on the gravel and the engine died in a dramatic cloud of steam. At the centre of the crossroads, nestling among the trees, was an object the shape of an upturned hubcap. 30 feet across? 50? Pulled some stunts at other people's expense in my time. Was someone trying to get one back? Make me look a fool? I could do that easily enough without anyone's help. I glanced around, but the place was deserted. A ramp slid from the side of the machine like a glittering fire escape in the sky. I felt as though some Glaswegian thug was tugging at my lapels. I unfastened my seatbelt, got out, and started walking. I reached the top of the ramp and went inside. The doorway remained open, but the sound of the woodland fell away, as if there was no air. Yet I felt as calm as when my body got the drink it craved. I was greeted by three, for the sake of argument, we'll call them people. Very well, I said. Look who's out of the woodwork, Huey, Dewey and Louie. They didn't seem too amused. Maybe they don't have amusement where they come from, or perhaps it was the accent or the obscure cultural reference to Silent Running. I love that film. I could see my face reflected in the one's big eye. What's up? I asked. You tell us, came the reply. I issued an involuntary, spluttering confession. I told them that in return for proving something to all the people on my fuck-off list, making myself irresistible to women, men, everything in between, and then some, as well as endless opportunities to find a place for me in history, I was supposed to be a cultural subversive, undermining all that was acceptable. Problem was, these days, I couldn't find the spark. I was a working class zero, locked in an alcohol-fueled loop of self-pity. So there I was, a sweating, trembling wreck. Get me out of this hell, I said. A door opened, and another goon wheeled in a hostess trolley, bearing what looked like a white plastic portable TV. A mishmash of generation game consolation prizes from a parallel universe. Give us a twirl, Anthea. A lever protruded from one side of the box. The screen flickered with white noise and obscure images, and I saw my life portrayed. always with the wrong crowd, but scared to break out from the crew. The stranger's bathroom, where I scratched my cheeks until they bled and punched myself so hard my face was bruised for days. The laughing monkey on my back. Jojo in the hospital, hooked up to the dialysis machine. The look in her eyes that told me that she'd soon go. Elizabeth. Fuck's this supposed to be, I said. The story of your life. If you want to, you can change something. But it's a random something. At what price? Jerk the handle and you'll die in your dreams. But the moment you win is undone. I looked at the screen, watched the images swirl and skew. If I could undo one thing, what one thing would that one thing be? My broken heart? Jojo's death? That first drink? It all contributed to what I had become. The past is not for sale, I said. Everything is for sale, they said. I looked at the screen. I used to be so handsome. When I was a much younger gentleman. I always knew that if I'd gone down the crossroads, I'd have told them yes. No, I said, and turned away. As I reached the car, I heard a sound like railway tracks singing as a train approaches. I turned and looked back. Trees, crossroads, fuck all else. Had I finally crossed the city limits? I got into the car and drove home, intoxicated by the smell of the overheating engine. Dedicated to the memory of Lee Scott Revell.
A Troubled Dream, The Woman in the Bath, by Yab Ye Yan Communications. I first started dreaming about the women in the bath in my mid-40s. Leastways, I think I did. Maybe I dreamt of her earlier in my life too. But if I did, it was lost to me amongst the other more pressing nighttime visitations and nocturnal meanderings of those younger years. Of all my troubled dreams, this is the one that has the most consistency of setting and action. Whilst far from a pleasant somnolent state, at least this consistency also gives me a somewhat pleasing sense of familiarity when I find myself back in this dream again. The woman in the bath sits upright in the long since cooled water. The water is waist deep, which is to say not very deep, given that she has her legs tucked beneath her. She is motionless, though alert and watchful. Her body is slight and angular, and the hair gathered in a loose topknot. The woman exudes a sense of calm, but her presence in the water is disquieting and worrying. I cannot see her face, but yet know, in the way that one just knows things in dreams, troubled or otherwise, that she is someone that I once loved. The bath is nothing fancy. The standard issue 1970s white enamelled affair with stubby taps at one end and one of those chains made of a string of little chromium balls linked together that disappears into the water at a slight angle to reach the black rubber plug. The bath is set against a wall, its front and sides made from white painted wood, framing a panel of tan coloured raffia. The floor is a dark blue linoleum, and the walls, magnolia tiles, with a border of stylized cornflowers at shoulder height that give on to an aged, matte white upper wall and ceiling. A single pendant light hangs above the bath, emitting a shallow hue through the narrow, cylindrical shade. The room is nowhere that I can recall, but aspects of it are clearly familiar to me from different contexts. The cornflowers, for example, I recall from a bed and breakfast I once stayed at in the Welsh Borders, and the blue linoleum graced the floor of my first bedsit in Liverpool. As I approach the side of the tub, I see that the woman is holding a greyish-blue Sylvine school exercise book in her hand. The cover of the book is empty, save for a printed rectangle towards the top containing four printed lines. The space between the second and third lines has the name William Drummond in neat uppercase letters. It is not recognisably my handwriting, but I instinctively know that it is my book and that I must open it. The cover is a little worn and scuffed with faint shadows of rust where the staples pierce the spine. The corners are bent and rounded and show signs of the off-white pages with their faint blue lines below. The woman hands me the book and motions me to sit on the edge of the bath to read it. Her face is still not visible to me, though I am close enough to make out the patina of her skin and see the goosebumps on her arm as I take the book. I turn and sit with my back towards her and open the book. Each time I have had this dream, and it has reoccurred many times, the contents of the book are new to me. Sometimes the pages are filled with scribbles, other times with images, drawings, and detailed sketches, and sometimes with acres of closely written notes or intricate maps and charts. One time, the book contained page after page of nautical signal flags. Another time, classic album covers. To date, I have been unable to discern any obvious pattern as to how the contents of the book relate to my current circumstances, mental state, location, health, or anything else. Regardless of the contents, the same basic scene unfolds time after time. I open the book to the first page and carefully study its contents. Time passes as I slowly examine and visually dissect each aspect of what is there, be it words, images, scribbles, or anything else. When a certain level of detailed distillation has occurred, I hear the woman in the bath behind me say the word yes, and I know it is my signal to turn to the next spread of pages. This process repeats itself page by page as I work my way through the book. If I attempt to turn the page too soon, I hear the woman in the bath say the word no, and return my gaze back to what is in front of me to study it in greater depth. Without fail, I always eventually find myself turning to the last page of the book, the one that faces the inside of the back cover. Independent of what the contents of the book have been on that occasion, this final page is always the same. Neatly written out in large block lettering in a strong black ink is the statement, "When will you know that it's enough?" As I turn to this page, I always hear the same twin sounds of the water draining off the lower body of the woman in the bath as she quickly stands behind me, and her voice intoning the words I have in front of me in the book. In the years of having had this recurring dream, I have never once failed to make my way slowly, painfully, through all the pages and reach the same conclusion.